Blog Talk Radio.
Show. I'm Lila.
I'm Leo. And tonight we've got an interesting show. We've got a lot of news for you.
We don't have a special guest tonight.
He'll be on tomorrow night. We'll be having almost an hour interview with Tex Mars, a prolific author and host of the Power of Prophecy website and radio show.
He also has a little newsletter.
Newsletter. But fascinating guy. But we've had him on a number of times before in our program and really enjoy having him. So
he'll be on tomorrow night.
Yeah. But in the meantime, I wanted to start off with some. We got a lot of health news tonight that I wanted to talk about. And also a number of video clips that I was hoping to play. Boom, 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 boom. Boy, I got so many, I don't know where to start. Let's see. This bothered me a lot. We had Dr. Cass Ingram on the other night, and he wrote this article. I'm going to refer you to it on the web, where healthfreedom2012.com is his website. And it says, they call it dirty politics. It says, child abuse rings are Romney and Santorum connected. And he says, they call it dirty politics, yet this takes politics to a new level. This is the sexual and physical abuse of youths for political and financial gain. An act sicker than can be imagined. American youths are brutalized on a daily basis. These youths are belittled and tormented. I'm going to go to this article because it's really quite sick that how Romney and Santorum are both connected to this child abuse ring.
And you'd be interested to know that this child abuse ring goes back quite a ways.
Yeah.
To Bush 1.
Right, which we spoke about on several of our shows, but at the last show we did, and I believe it was January, mm-hmm. we spoke to Rick Bryant, who wrote the book called The Franklin Scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. cites that in this article, but let me just start, and Lila and I will finish the article. It's not all that long, but it's important to read. They are even tortured and imprisoned. They are psychologically tormented. They are accosted and raped. Food and water is denied to them. It is wicked beyond belief. Moreover, it is all real and undeniable. Even worse, today, political candidates are indelibly tied to it. That may shock some people, yet these ties are impossible to refute.
Who are these candidates who are directly tied to this abuse?
Yep.
They are Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum. The ties are largely through so-called Republican Party power brokers. Sembler's role as an agent of corruption is beyond dispute. Yet because of his political favors, he has been given many high appointments, says Arnold Trebek, professor emeritus of law at American University. As a proud American, I find Melvin Sembler, our ambassador to Italy, and his wife Betty to be profound embarrassments. It is important that their advice on the drug war, and especially on drug treatment, be ignored. Indeed, it might be best if Italians listened to what this powerful couple had to say about drugs and then followed policies in precisely the opposite direction. There are surely many doubters. Then it was Reason.com's Maya Salzevitz who titled her article in June 2007, Romney, Torture in Teens, says John Gorenfeld. For 16 years, Sembler, with his wife Betty, directed the leading juvenile rehab business in America Straight Incorporated, before seeing it dismantled by a breathtaking array of institutional abuse claims. Let's
By mid-1993,
yes.
Just one of the many survivors of Samantha Monroe, now a travel agent in Pennsylvania, who told the Montel Williams show this year about overcoming beatings, raped by a counselor, forced hunger, and a confinement to a janitor's closet in humble pants, which contained weeks of her own urine, feces, and menstrual blood. During this time out, she nods her cheek and spat blood at her overseers. I refused to let them take my mind, she said. She says of the program, the abuse took years to overcome.
This is no isolated case. According to sworn testimony, as described by Barry Berenstein in his book Thought Reform and The Road to Hell, straight often left restrained group members sitting in their own urine, feces, or vomit until suitable concessions were extracted. According to the Cafferty report, Sembler's evil knows no bounds, as Cafferty noted. Soon enough, Straight's tactics took up to it in the courts. A college student won a false imprisonment claim of $220,000 in 1983, and another claim cost Straight Incorporated $721,000 in 1990. A Straight Incorporated spinoff called Kids of New Jersey settled a $4.5 million abuse claim in 2000. Straight chapters across the country began to shut down, culminating with the last branch in Atlanta closing in 1993. Now, make no mistake about it, Romney's involvement is far from incidental. Sembler is his national finance co-chair. Commonly, Romney shows a kind of brutally arrogant mean streak before the people, especially the pitiful and the vulnerable. Then again, Sembler is the founder of Straight, and thus all the acts which were achieved there, all the abuse, torment, and oppression, all the sadistic acts of child abuse, torture, and rape, but also all the murders were under his watch. Sembler is responsible for these. In a large degree, Sembler is Romney. It is not just the victims who attested to this, notes Maya Salzevitz in her 2007 article. At all Straight facilities, state investigators documented scores of abuses, including teens being beaten, deprived of food and sleep for days, restrained by fellow youth for hours, bound and sexually humiliated, abused, and spat upon. According to the LA Times, California investigators determined that the teens at Sembler's clinic were subject to unusual punishment, infliction of pain, humiliation, intimidation, ridicule, coercion, threats, and mental abuse. In addition, the most basic functions of life always taken for granted for the young and developing, such as eating, sleeping, and toileting, were denied to them. Sadistic monsters, how else can they be described?
That Romney is involved with such a man does not bode well for his potential as a ruler of the land.
Yeah.
Yet then, they have more in common with each other than mere political campaigning. These various clinics are not just run by anybody. Rather, many are run either by the Democratic Party or the GOP. In these various facilities, many of which are similar to those presided over upon by Sembler, following fatalities occurred. This one I found was where Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Aaron Albert Gray, 16 years old, died of unexplained causes in 2001. Aaron Wright Bacon. There's a list of them. There's many.
And then they jump down to this paragraph. These are just a few of the victims of this murderous system. The world should be screaming at the top of its lungs at these crimes, yet hardly a word is not spoken nor a memory voiced. It would seem that Romney's association with Semler is more than merely for political connections. There is something far more diabolical here. Consider another Romney associate, Robert Litchfield, the founder of the so-called Worldwide Association of Specialty Schools. Litchfield operated dozens of schools across this country and overseas, most of which were shut down after allegations of abuse. According to legal filings, teens were locked in outdoor dog cages, exercised to exhaustion, deprived of food and sleep, and exposed to extreme temperatures without adequate clothing or water. They were also beaten severely to the point of causing physical wounds and sexually abused, suffering every conceivable humiliation. Some were even made to eat their own vomit. All this occurred under Romney's control. Now, how is that under Romney's control?
Here is another example of his direct involvement. In 1984, Romney founded Bain Capital Group, which operated Aspen Educational Group. One of its facilities in Oregon was shut down by the Department of Human Services after substantial child abuse was proven by investigators. In one case, in yet another program, a 16-year-old boy died from what was determined to be reckless acts by the Romney subsidiary. The former Romney group has been slammed with a number of lawsuits for emotional, physical, and sexual abuse of the juveniles. These youths were subjected to sadistic punishments, such as having to reenact traumatic experiences, including prior instances of child sexual abuse before fellow residents, extreme isolation, prolonged deprivation of food and water, as well as shelter and basic medical care. The victims, it was reported, were required to go days with little or no sleep and also regularly forced into chain gang style labor. And yet additional torment phone calls to families were limited but also monitored, and parents were instructed by staff not to believe their children if they claimed abuse. In other words, parents were instructed that, as a routine, their children would lie and should not be believed. It was part of the process.
As if to confirm the malicious nature of the entity, this Romney subsidiary established the following waiver and release signed in advance by parents delivering their children. Sponsors intend by this waiver and release in advance to waive his or her rights and discharge each and every one of the release parties from any and all claims for damages, death, personal injury, or past property damage which sponsors may have or which may hereafter accrue as a result of the student's participation, even though that liability may arise from negligence or careless or from dangerous, defective property or equipment.
Additionally, sponsor covenants not to sue any of the sponsors. A history of sadism also surrounds Santorum. It was this man who was indelibly tied to the vile monster and noted child rapist Jerry Sandusky. Yes, it's true. Despite plausible denials, Santorum is directly connected with a pedophilia ring headed by ex-assistant Penn State coach Jerry Sandusky, the founder of a Pennsylvania-based charity purporting to aid troubled juveniles. Second Miles Sandusky used the facility for far different reasons than are claimed. The orphaned, troubled, and vulnerable children, teens he took in, were, in fact, commonly raped. Sandusky himself had sex with dozens of them.
It gets even worse. As reported originally by Wayne Madsen, Sandusky and his vile ones farmed numerous of these children out to be used as sex objects. This was by the mighty and rich, including U.S. congressmen and senators, as well as rich donors. Like Sandusky, Santorum housed these juveniles as pages, making them ultimately available to both the wealthy and Washington, D.C.-based politicians. That's why he tries to deflect people from the issue. Yet, what was Santorum's position on Sandusky? He regarded him so highly that he personally gave him an award, the Congressional Angels in Adoption Award. It is beyond belief that Santorum orchestrated award honored him for ruining the lives of vulnerable children and adolescents. Sandusky has since publicly admitted his proclivity for these acts.
When NBC Bob Costas interviewed Sandusky, asking him, "Are you sexually attracted to boys or underage boys?" he responded, as if he didn't hear the question, "I am sexually attracted."
Am I?
Will you let me finish?
Well, you didn't read it.
I wish you wouldn't interrupt me.
Well, you didn't read
it
properly.
Okay. Am I sexually attracted to underage boys? Yes. The man is so fixed in his rot that he couldn't resist proclaiming this, even on national TV. He also admitted that he was caught sexually abusing a 10-year-old boy in a shower at Penn State. In describing the unspeakable, said assistant coach Mike McCleary, who witnessed the act, Sandusky was raping the child in the anus. McCleary reported this directly to the head coach, Joe Paterno. However, Paterno failed to report it to the police. As the traumatized youths kept coming forward, lawsuits for sexual abuse were launched. As a result, Santorum and Sandusky's Angelic Adoption Center was shuttered and all assets seized in order to settle the suits. Now, while Santorum denies it, he is indelibly tied to Sandusky.
As revealed by Wayne Madsen in the Madsen Report, these men work closely not only in the Second Mile Project, but also directly in placing the youths in harm's way. Santorum himself used these youths in his office as pages. In other words, regarding these highly vulnerable juveniles, the two worked as a team. However, now when asked about it, what does Santorum say? He says that as reported on November 8, 2011 by the Philadelphia Inquirer, he does not know Sandusky personally. Then who presented the award? His fairy godmother? Santorum also defended those high ones at Penn State, saying they should be treated leniently. Even after child rape was officially reported by the police, the highly compromised Santorum stood strong for both Sandusky and Paterno, and instead of defending the families and children. When people questioned Paterno's failure to report the crime to police, what is a state law against? Santoro came to his defense. In contrast, he never said a word of concern about the victims or their families, and that's a big never. The family values candidate can now be categorically renamed the unfamily values candidate. Yes, though Santorum's blockade, how many other people were harmed? How many other youths were raped and abused because of the indifference of Santorum, Penn State officials, and their likes? As a former senator and close associate of Sandusky, he was in a position to help to make the revelations that could have prevented further horrors. He could have assisted those tormented ones, cooperating with police. Now this individual instead, not this individual, instead he maintained the cover of the perpetrators. This is not the first time Santorum ran cover for pedophiles. In 2006 on PCN TV during the Mark Foley scandal, when interviewed about the issue of the molestation of pages, he said,
"You know, if we're talking about page programs when the national security of this country is hanging in the balance, and the media says, 'No, don't pay attention to that, let's focus on this.' And clearly, Santorum was running interference for Foley, but was that the only reason for his attempt to distract? Even so, regarding Foley, while he had all along been molesting congressional pages, it was only when a degree of evidence surfaced that brought this to light. So what was Santorum's defending? It was surely not family values, but acts that are the most anti-family conceivable. It was suggestive emails and sexually explicit instant messages sent to underage males who were at that time working as congressional pages. Yes, Santorum did the inconceivable. He took action to distract attention from this. As a family candidate, isn't his duty to do the opposite, which is to bring attention to molestation on the basis of the family, which is the children? Shouldn't he have been held strong in defense of the pages and their families, calling for the most extreme measures to protect the innocent, the tormented? Instead, he sought to cause people to focus on some supposed external threat, those dangerous Muslims, which he merely invents. And what kind of sick animal is he that he would maliciously and purposely run interference for Foley, just like he did for the perpetrators at Penn State? And after all, it was Foley himself which said himself had said, as reported by Satun Khanna, that his lurid emails were just a momentary lapse of judgment, while admitting that he carried on the computer conversations for months, asking about masturbation, sex, and other details. In real life, no one does this with juveniles except a pervert. And would anyone want that done to their sons or daughters? And he even had the audacity to say that he's not a pedophile, just the pages were almost 18.
Now, but, have no doubt about it. I think this is quite long.
Yeah, this goes pretty long. And I think I just thought that we should,
touch on it anyway.
It's pretty graphic. And Gass was the author of this. Was right on with this thing, and I'm glad he brought it up. And he has a number of websites and stuff too, for his resources. But I would like everybody to go to this, if you could, Health Freedom 2012 blog. I believe it's HF blog, and check it out. And that took 20 minutes to pull that one off, but I thought it was really important. So I don't know.
It's quite a long read, but we gave you the meat of it anyway.
Yeah. And
a few more paragraphs.
Yeah. This one, we got enough time. I wanted to get into this here, but how GMO foods alter organ function and pose a very real health threat to humans. I thought we could go into that. And then I've got several videos that I wanted to play here. Let's see if this, I don't think this is too long. We've got one here with this. Mike Adams.
It's a health ranger on that one.
Yeah. I think he's, and he talks about this here. So that's kind of long, though.
Over 70% of corn, soy, and other staple grains on the market today have been genetically modified, mostly either to resist herbicides or produce their own pesticides on a cellular level. As if those figures weren't high enough, approximately 80% of all packaged foods in the U.S. contain GMOs, genetically modified organisms, or GMOs have been sold as food since 1992. When the biotech companies convinced the government that speeding these new products past inspection and regulation would improve U.S. exports. Normally, in order to receive the label of generally recognized as safe, new products have to undergo extensive testing from third-party sources, and there must be nearly unanimous consensus among the scientific community that there are no dangerous side effects. These new crops are given the FDA's official seal of approval without any outside testing, and in blatant defiance of what scientific evidence there already is against these dangerous new plants. As far as the FDA is concerned, as long as the companies say that their products are harmless, they are. GMOs are now almost everywhere, entirely unregulated, and they aren't even labeled. Companies can even release new strains to the market without telling the government.
That's sick,
Unsurprisingly, numerous tests and real-world examples have shown that the dangerous and toxic effects of these crops on humans and animals. According to Say No to GMOs essay, thoroughly sourced with over 120 scientific essays and new articles, genetically modified organisms have been linked to thousands of toxic and allergic-type reactions, thousands of sick, sterile, and dead livestock, and damage to virtually every organ and system studied in lab animals. Nearly every independent animal feeding safety study shows adverse or unexplained effects. These toxic effects from both animal tests and the actual accounts of farm animals allowed to graze on GMO products include liver damage, intestinal damage, high mortality rates, infant mortality rates of 51.6% in rats, reproductive failure, sterility, weakened or activated immune systems, and inflammation related to lethal allergic reactions. Researchers found that the same year GMO soy was introduced to Great Britain, soy allergies in the country went up by 50%. Proteins in soy also cross-reacted with peanut allergies, and in the 5 years after GMO soy was introduced to America, rates of peanut allergies increased by 100%. Once again, genetically modified organisms are not labeled. However, organic foods are not allowed to have any GMO ingredients. It's just one of the many reasons why Top Line Foods have collected all the best organic products we can find for your safety and convenience.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to go to this article, and it's on Occupy for Animals. And check that out. Okay. This was something that I was surprised at, that virgin coconut oil halts severe dementia in 35 days.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was amazing. And
if that's true, it certainly is.
Well, yeah, I mean, the article seemed to, you know, be legit. And
I hope it's true. That'd be wonderful.
It would be incredible, you know.
This is from the Healthy Home Economist.
Yeah.
That's a site I never heard of.
Me neither, until I got this article
after
from someone on Facebook.
Helplessly watching her 58-year-old husband, 58, that's not very old,
that's
rapidly degenerate into severe dementia only 5 years after MRI diagnosis with Alzheimer's, Mrs. Newport decided to pursue an unorthodox treatment of his condition with virgin coconut oil instead of the expensive drug Axina, which has the drawback of producing intestinal distress in some patients and wears off with just a few hours of injection. Mary Newport, a neonatal pediatrician at Spring Hill Regional Hospital in Florida, learned through research that the active ingredient in Axina is MCT, also known as median chain triglycerides, a saturated fat used to treat epilepsy as well as in neonatal feeding programs. Since virgin coconut oil is loaded with MCTs, Dr. Newport began an intensive feeding program for her husband that consisted of mixing 2BL virgin
tablespoons.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah. TBL. Two tablespoons
of coconut oil and MCT pharmaceutical isolate with every meal. Within 35 days, Steve Newport's rapid neurological decline was arrested, and 18 months later, he has recovered enough brain function and normal behavior to test as only a mild case of Alzheimer's, the same tests which, before starting the VCO feeding program, had him indicated that he was borderline severe dementia. Wow. As a bonus, Steve Newport's cholesterol profile has improved significantly by adding this healthy saturated fat to his diet with good cholesterol going up and bad cholesterol going down. Dr. Newport now travels all over the United States relaying this valuable story of her husband's recovery from borderline severe dementia using VCO to essentially rebuild his brain. She is a strong advocate for continued research into the use of MCTs as a therapy for those with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and other debilitating neurological diseases. Coconut oil provides super fuel to the brain.
Okay. Dr. Bruce Fife, author of Stop Alzheimer's Now, recommended VCO instead of MCT drugs, such as Axona, because the drugs become ineffective over time, wear off quickly, and have side effects and cause free radical damage to the cells. When the MCTs in virgin coconut oil are converted into ketones, they act as super fuel for the brain. And this fuel, super fuel, provides energy to the brain as well as stimulates healing and repair.
Mm.
It is the chemical structure of the MCTs in coconut oil that allow them to pass the blood-brain barrier that ordinary food or oils cannot.
Hmm. How to source quality virgin coconut oil? If someone you love is suffering from a neurodegenerative illness, help them by adding virgin and coconut oil to their diet. The research is showing what traditional cultures, such as those in the Pacific Islands, have known for centuries. Coconut oil keeps you healthy. To source, please refer to, you go to this article and go to the end of it and you go to my resource page, which identifies companies that offer only the finest organic virgin coconut oil from sustainable sources.
There you go.
So anyway, that's... So if you know anyone with Alzheimer's or someone in your family
or dementia
suffering from that, I mean, what can you lose by trying this?
Coconut oil.
Virgin coconut oil. I mean, it helped the man in 35 days, and with 18 months, he made a dramatic recovery.
Yeah, that's got to tell you something, huh? So, anyway, I'm going to play, I wanted to go to a quick video. You think we should do the cannabis one, or?
Yeah, how long? Yeah, why don't you do that one?
About 10 minutes, and the other one I wanted to do is, this one on fluoride tonight. So maybe we'll do both.
Okay. Go ahead.
I lost where I was here.
You want the one on cannabis on the...
I'd like to do this this tonight. It's about a 10-minute video.
The power of raw cannabis.
Yeah. This is a much-watched video. Some top research on the healing effects of cannabis. Or marijuana in its raw form, eaten or juiced, right? And let's try this out. I think it's fascinating.
My name is Dr. William Courtney. I'm involved in the raw use of cannabis as a dietary essential. In that capacity, you can use 60 times more than you can tolerate if heated. And in that capacity, it's very potent anti-inflammatory that will find a very broad population of interest in this country.
Oncology at San Francisco General Hospital and a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. I do research in medical cannabis applications. I mean, if cannabis were discovered in an Amazon rainforest today, people would be clamoring to make as much use as they could of all of the potential benefits of the plant. I think, unfortunately, it carries with it, you know, a long, maybe not so long history of being a persecuted plant.
Five years ago, I wouldn't prescribe cannabis for a fellow I went to medical school with because I was such a skeptic. And now it's real clear to me that cannabis, it's a vegetable. It's not psychoactive until humans alter it chemically. No other animal alters it. So the whole psychoactive thing is a human aspect of the plant that has nothing to do with the 34 million years of evolution that the plant has. It's captured these molecules that help our body's regulatory system be more effective. And its bottom line is it's a dietary essential that helps all 210 cell types function more effectively. And so I never even refer to it as medicine anymore, strictly as a dietary essential. It only becomes medicine once you have a breakdown and a condition has become very serious in the system, your body is being overwhelmed. Then cannabis can be manipulated, i.e. heated, concentrated, to become a medicine. But in its best form, it's a preventative. And preventing diabetes is a lot better than trying to treat it. Preventing cancer is a lot better than trying to treat it.
I think cannabis is a medicine that is anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, and probably has some direct activity against cancerous cells.
The federal patent is phenomenal. The Department of Health and Human Services since 2003 has had intellectual property on CBD, and CBD is, you know, is a molecule that's coming out of the shadows from THC. It doesn't produce that psychoactive. The majority of my patients don't want to get high at 8 o'clock in the morning and be high all day long. But a lot of them do have arthritis and car accidents, you know, autoimmune disorders, rheumatoid, and they start out their day in pain, and they're in pain most of the day long. And so they're looking for relief but clarity, and that's what these eating the plant raw, and that's you not only need CBD. CBD is a non-psychoactive, whether it's CBD acid, which is how it's found in the raw plant, or CBD, which is what happens after you cook it or heat it or steep it or turn it into tea or something. But THC acid is the real tricky molecule in the raw plant, totally non-psychoactive, phenomenally beneficial as a molecule. Once it's heated, it turns into THC, and then the tolerable dose drops from hundreds of milligrams a day to 10. And with 10 milligrams, you stimulate the CB1 receptor, you get that psychoactive effect, either dysphoria or euphoria, but you walk away from 99% of the benefits of this plant, which are bone remodeling, intestinal function, neural function, you know, inflammation control, cancer, precancerous detection. You know, this plant can do phenomenal things, but not if you're taking 10 milligrams rather than, you know, the 600 milligrams that the FDA is currently approving as an investigative new drug.
My name is Kristen Piskuski, and I went from being bedridden and on over 40 medications a day to control my health problems to being a mother, to being healthy, happy, and vital, thanks to using green leaf that I juice on a daily basis. Yeah, I was diagnosed with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis when I was 16, and then interstitial cystitis, painful bladder condition, endometriosis, cervical cancer. I was told I was sterile and would never have children. And hypothyroidism, chronic infections. I've had 16 surgical procedures. And I'm resistant to most antibiotics and have chronic infections. And I can't take a lot of Western medicine drugs because of the allergies that I have. I also have asthma. I'm allergic to most environmental factors and different skin rashes, and I have a broken back in 3 places.
Man. So how did you discover this new way of juicing?
I discovered cannabis was helpful for the conditions because when I would smoke cannabis for pain, I had fewer infections. So I started to look into whether cannabis was doing more than just masking the pain. And I moved to California to be able to use cannabis legally, but I still didn't have the type of healing that I anticipated with smoked and heated cannabis. So after talking to several cannabis physicians and attending different lectures, I found out that there's the THC acid and CBD acid that you get in the raw form have medicinal properties that are better at helping my immune system to communicate. So as soon as I began doing that, it took about 6 weeks, and I was infection-free, and all of my conditions went into remission.
So what many of my patients do is they plant a plant every day, and they pick a plant every day. If you let the plant grow to a certain size, you may be able to use half a plant a day, so a plant, therefore, would last for 2 days. So therefore, you need one plant every other day. So the total number of plants depends on whether you have a plant a day, a plant every other, or a plant every 3 days, depending on the space available. But most of them are trying to do this whole thing on a single 400-watt light, and they use a fluorescent light to keep a mother alive, and they produce a clone, they start a plant. They pick the whole plant, strip the leaf and flower, juice that. Good indication that the roots are also useful. Stalk is a little fibrous, can bind up a lot of juicers and ruin the juicer because it's just so strong. So I generally strip the stalk, throw that away because it's just too fibrous. But juice that, it produces a small amount of juice, very concentrated, quite acidic. Yeah, that has to be diluted. You can dilute it with fresh vegetable juice, fruit juice, or something that you buy off the shelf.
The only time I've needed antibiotics in the last 4 years is when I was unable to do the juicing regime because I was overseas. And as well, I was pregnant for the first time with my daughter, Zahia. And when I came back, I had a horrible sinus infection, and they were unable to treat it with 3 different antibiotics. And the rheumatologist at UCSF I was working with thought that I may need to go back on methotrexate and prednisone, and 3 weeks after I got home and I had been juicing again, everything cleared up, and I didn't have to go on any of the drugs or take another antibiotic.
And at this point, I'm developing strains. Yesterday, I stumbled on a strain that's 22% CBD acid. The plant that I had the day before, that was 1%. A absolutely phenomenal change in the plant's chemical composition, and particularly as it impacts, you know, are you violating federal patents if you're using this plant? I mean, if they're commercially going to use CBD, then you have to deal with the patent. But individual use as a dietary element, the U.S. patent just is clear evidence as to why you want to eat this plant as a leafy green vegetable and include it in your diet several times a day.
I depend on right now on people who give me leaf because my partner is a cannabis physician, and we worry about the legalities of growing our own right now and whether it could jeopardize his medical license. But we have a lot of patients that are able to grow less than 30 plants, and this allows them a fresh plant every day for juicing.
My number one project is to get the Convention 1 Treaty, which is a UN committee that produced this treaty that all, I think there's 104 countries that have signed onto it, which says if you have grow, possess, transport cannabis, you should be imprisoned. And that is the document that every country in this world pounds people into the ground, cuts their heads off, imprisons them. And so you take this information that unheated, it's not psychoactive, it's a vegetable that improves the function of your immune system and bone metabolism and musculoskeletal. Once the world knows that this is, it's a vegetable, that's all it is, the most important vegetable on the planet, then these various things that are in place that prohibit people from having access will change. And so my issue, one of my agendas now is to try to get the treaty amended to remove cannabis so that cannabis can be available to everyone in the world as a dietary supplement.
And anyone who knows somebody who's sick, who has a loved one with an illness or themselves has suffered from one, understands that there are more important things to look at, and we have to be able to adapt. If what we're doing doesn't fit with what's needed in the world today, if how we make our living isn't supporting, it's not sustaining people's health, then we need to be able to grow and adapt and change.
You don't want to go from, you know, I guess a lot of incarcerations to suddenly, you know, it's a dietary essential. I mean, how do you make that leap? And so I'm hoping that we're in a phase where, you know, we're gradually letting go of yesterday's nightmares and embracing the fact that, you know, it's patented for its benefits, it's approved by the FDA, and in fact is clearly a dietary essential that should be in everyone's diet. So I'm hoping that the DEA, which is lagging behind, will, you know, on cue with the whole organization, decide that, okay, well, let's go ahead and reschedule this because, you know, clearly we can't have a patent on its utility and say it has no utility. I mean, the conflict is just, it's patently absurd.
Wonderful, because it could be a miracle for others.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I mean, it has been. I've seen numerous videos on
well,
cannabis.
Well, I'd like to see if it's available for people so that they can use it.
Of course, so you can grow it. You can have it in your garden. And you can,
exactly. Well, if you don't grow your own, you could buy it from a grower.
No, but I mean, it should be legal to grow, you know? I mean, it should be legal to grow.
Just like carrots or onions or tomatoes or
anything
else.
Exactly.
It's a vegetable.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. All right. There's something else that I wanted to play tonight that I thought was very, very interesting, which was the fluoride is a toxic waste.
Now, how long
literally,
is that?
Okay. It's about 10 minutes.
Okay, we can probably do that.
And, I know we can do that. And we will do that right now. So, for any of you This video is based on the article from Fluoride Action Network.
FluorideActionNetwork.com.
Right. Yeah, there's a link in the description. Yeah, well, you can go to that. FluorideActionNetwork.com.
They call them wet scrubbers. The pollution control devices used by the phosphate industry to capture fluoride gases produced in the production of commercial fertilizer. In the past, when the industry let these gases escape, vegetation became scorched, crops destroyed, and cattle crippled. Today, with the development of sophisticated air pollution control technology, less of the fluoride escapes into the atmosphere, and the type of pollution that threatened the survival of some communities in the 1950s and 60s is but a thing of the past, at least in the U.S. and other wealthy countries. However, the impacts of the industry's fluoride emissions are still being felt, although more subtly, by millions of people, people who, for the most part, do not live anywhere near a phosphate plant. That's because after being captured in the scrubbers, the fluoride acid, hydrofluorosilic acid, a classified hazardous waste, is barreled up and sold, unrefined, to communities across the country. Communities add hydrofluorosilic acid to their water supplies as the primary fluoride chemical for water fluoridation. Even if you don't live in a community where fluoride is added to the water, you're still getting a high dose of it through cereal, soda, juice, beer, and any other processed food and drink manufactured with fluoridated water. Fluoride has been and remains to this day one of the largest liabilities of the phosphate industry. The source of the problem lies in the fact that raw phosphate ore contains high concentrations of fluoride, usually between 20,000 and 40,000 parts per million, equivalent to 2 to 4% of the ore. When this ore is processed into water-soluble phosphate via the addition of sulfuric acid, the fluoride content of the ore is vaporized into the air, forming highly toxic gaseous compounds, hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride. In the past, when the industry had little, if any, pollution control, the fluoride gases were frequently emitted in large volumes into the surrounding communities, causing serious environmental damage. In Polk County, Florida, the creation of multiple phosphate plants in the 1940s caused damage to nearly 25,000 acres of citrus groves and, quote, mass fluoride poisoning, unquote, of cattle. It estimated that as a result of the fluoride contamination, the cattle population of Polk County dropped 30,000 head between 1953 and 1960, and an estimated 150,000 acres of cattle land were abandoned. Damage to vegetation and livestock caused by fluoride emissions from large industry has resulted, as one might expect, in a great deal of expensive litigation. In 1983, Dr. Leonard Weinstein of Cornell University stated that certainly there had been more litigation on alleged damage to agriculture by fluoride than all other pollutants combined. While Weinstein was referring to fluoride pollution in general, his comments give an indication of a problem facing the phosphate industry, one of the most notorious emitters of fluoride in the early days. So, too, does an estimate from Dr. Ewan Groth, currently a senior scientist at Consumers Union. According to an article written by Groth, fluoride pollution between the years 1957 to 1968, quote, was responsible for more damage claims against industry than all 20 nationally monitored air pollutants combined. According to Hodge and Smith in 1977, the primary reason for the litigation against fluoride emitters was the, quote, painful, economic, disastrous, debilitating disease that fluoride causes to livestock. Lilly in 1970 said, quote, airborne fluorides have caused more worldwide damage to domestic animals than any other air pollutant. Due to the inevitable liabilities that fluoride pollution presented and to the increasingly stringent set of environmental regulations, the phosphate industry began cleaning up its act. As noted by Irving Bellick, a chemist at the U.S. Public Health Service, quote, in the manufacture of superphosphate fertilizer, phosphate rock is acidulated with sulfuric acid, and the fluoride content of the rock evolves as volatile silical fluorides. In the past, much of this volatile material was vented to the atmosphere, contributing heavily to pollution of the air and the land surrounding the manufacturing site. As awareness of the pollution problem increased, scrubbers were added to strip particulate and gaseous compounds from the waste gas. Considering the great demand among big industry for fluoride chemicals as a material used in a wide variety of commercial products and industrial processes, the phosphate industry could have made quite a handsome profit selling its fluoride wastes to industry. This was indeed the hope of some industry analysts. However, the U.S. phosphate industry has thus far been unable to take advantage of this market. The principal reason for this failure stems from the fact that fluoride captured in the scrubbers is combined with silica. The resulting silica-fluoride complex has in turn proved difficult for the industry to separate and purify in an economically viable process. As it now stands, silica fluoride complexes, hydrofluorosilic acid and sodium silica fluoride, are of little use to industry. Thus, while U.S. industry continues to satisfy its growing demand for high-grade fluoride chemicals by importing calcium fluoride from abroad, primarily Mexico, China, and South Africa, the phosphate industry continues dumping large volumes of fluoride into acidic wastewater ponds that lie at the top of mountainous waste piles which surround the industry. Of course, not all the phosphate industry's fluoride waste is disposed of in the ponds. As noted earlier, the phosphate industry has found at least one regular customer of its silica fluorides, municipal water treatment facilities. According to recent estimates, the phosphate industry sells approximately 200,000 tons of silica fluorides, hydrofluorosilic acid, and sodium silica fluoride to U.S. communities each year for use as water fluoridation agents. In 1983, Rebecca Hanmer from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency described the policy of using phosphate industry silica fluorides for fluoridation as follows. Quote, in regards to the use of fluorosilic acid as a source of fluoride for fluoridation, this agency regards such use as an ideal solution to a long-standing problem. By recovering the byproduct fluorosilic acid from fertilizer manufacturing, water and air pollution are minimized, and water authorities have a low-cost source of fluoride available to them. Another EPA official, Dr. J. William Hersey, the current senior vice president of EPA headquarters union, recently expressed a different view on the matter. According to Hersey, quote, if this stuff gets into our air, it's a pollutant. If it gets into a river, it's a pollutant. If it gets into a lake, it's a pollutant. But if it goes right into your drinking water system, it's not a pollutant? That's amazing. There's got to be a better way to manage this stuff. Adding to Hersey's concerns are three recent findings. First and foremost are two recent studies reporting a relationship between water treated with silica fluorides and elevated levels of lead in children's blood. The authors of these studies speculate that the silica fluoride complex may increase the uptake of lead derived from other environmental sources, such as lead paint, into the bloodstream. The second finding is the recent and quite remarkable concession from the EPA that despite 50 years of water fluoridation, the EPA has no chronic health studies on silica fluorides. All safety studies on fluoride to date have been conducted using pharmaceutical-grade sodium fluoride, not industrial-grade silica fluorides. The defense made by the agencies promoting water fluoridation, such as U.S. Centers for Disease Control, to the lack of studies is that when the silica fluoride complex is diluted into water, it dissociates into free fluoride ions or fluoride compounds, and thus the treated water, when consumed, will have no remaining silica fluoride residues. This argument, while supported by a good deal of theoretical calculation, is backed by a notable lack of laboratory data. Moreover, a recently obtained and translated PhD dissertation from a German chemist contradicts the claims. According to the dissertation, not only do the silica fluorides not fully dissociate, the remaining silica fluoride complexes are more potent inhibitors of chlorinesterase, an enzyme vital to the functioning of the central nervous system. A third finding, although perhaps of less concern, is that the silica fluorides, as obtained from the scrubbers of the phosphate industry, contain a wide variety of impurities present in processed water, including arsenic, lead, and possibly radionuclides. While these impurities occur at low concentrations, especially after dilution into water, their purposeful addition to water supplies directly violates EPA public health goals. As noted by the Salt Lake Tribune, those who had visions of sterile white laboratories when they voted for fluoride weren't thinking of fluorosilic acid. Improbable as this sounds, much of it is recovered from the scrubbing solution that scours toxin from smokestacks at phosphate fertilizer plants. Silica fluorides corrode glass. They have never had a study done on human beings before, and they are added directly to our water supplies. Go to fluoridealert.org for more information and references to everything that I've said here. Send this video to your congressman or your mayor or your local municipal water supplier. There are a few ways to filter out silica fluorides from your water. I will link a few options in the description section of this video. Thank you for your time.
I guess you have to get your own
filters.
Filters.
Yeah. Okay. I'm thinking, why don't we take a quick music break, and then we're gonna people will be up in a few minutes.
In term demands Afghan apology for
Quran burning
reaction.
Yeah,
would he be out of his mind?
He's an idiot. Complete and utter idiot. Mr. Moron. And
he takes the obvious and turns it around.
He's a moron. Yeah. U.S. Republican presidential hopeful Rick Santorum has demanded Afghans to apologize for overreacting to the burning of the Holy Quran copies of Air Force American forces. I think the response needs to be apologized for by Karzai and the Afghan people for attacking and killing our men and women in uniform and overreacting to this inadvertent mistake. The guy's a freaking moron. I mean, we're over there murdering thousands of these people, okay? And yet you say, they shouldn't be hurting us. And, Meet the Press show on Sunday. That is the real crime, not what our soldiers did, he said. On February 20th, U.S. soldiers burned the copies of the Holy Quran and other Islamic texts at the U.S.-run Bagram Air Base, located 11 kilometers southeast of the city of Shankar in the northern province of Parwan. The sacrilegious act of U.S. forces sparked days of violent protests in Afghanistan, resulting in more than 30 deaths, including two high-ranking U.S. military personnel killed in Afghanistan's Interior Ministry. The Republican presidential hopeful also rapped President Barack Obama for apologizing to the Afghan people over the incident. Obama's apology made it sound like there was something that you should apologize for, and they're not, and that was no act that needed an apology, Santorum insisted. Obama had sent a letter of apology to his Afghan counterpart, Hamid Karzai, on Thursday.
And rightly so.
The comments by Santorum come as Newt Gingrich, another Republican presidential hopeful, has similarly deplored Obama's apology for the desecration of the Holy Quran by American forces, describing it as astonishing and undeserved. Well, Obama is consistently apologizing for to people who do not deserve the apology of the President of the United States, period, said Gingrich. Despite the U.S. President's apology and a call for restraint by Afghan President Karzai, the anti-U.S. force U.S. demonstrations are continuing across Afghanistan. The desecration of the Holy Quran underscores the insensitivity of the U.S.-led forces to the cultural and religious values of the rituals of Afghanistan more than 10 years after they invade the Asian nation to remove the Taliban from power. The insecurity continues to rise across Afghanistan despite the presence of some 130,000 U.S.-led troops in the war-wracked country. So, anyway, I thought that was interesting. That this idiot would be such an idiot. Yeah. Let's see, we got two more minutes. Why don't we take a quick music break?
Okay.
Wouldn't that be nice? And then we'll be back and with
In the ring.
Woody in the ring, yeah. Let's see. Two. I like this song.
Thank you. Wow, what a segue. Thank you, Lila.
Oh, you're welcome.
How's my signal this evening?
You sound very good, just like that.
Ah, fantastic. Well, let's get on with it then. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the rope as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, Jim Calhoun, less is definitely more. And, of course, we'll talk a little baseball. It is pitchers and catchers. So let's get right down to it. Connecticut's men's basketball coach, Jim Calhoun, underwent what the school says was successful surgery to address the spinal condition that forced him to miss the Huskies' past seven games. The two-hour surgery was performed out of state, mind you, at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. Obviously, Connecticut hospitals not being good enough to do back surgery for Jim Calhoun. It involved removing a large extruded disc fragment that had been pressing on a spinal nerve, the school said. School says Calhoun's coaching status will be monitored on a day-to-day basis, and there is no timetable set for his return. He is expected to be released from the hospital today, and his recovery will be monitored by his personal physician, the school said. UConn, 17-11 and 7-9 in the Big East, has gone 3-4 during Calhoun's medical leave, and 5-5 without his coach this season. The team will play without him at Providence tonight, which is a tough game for them. Associate head coach George Blaney will again coach the team. Calhoun told the AP Saturday that he hopes to be back in time to coach the regular season finale against Pittsburgh on Saturday. Calhoun turned 70 in May and is a three-time cancer survivor. There's been talks over the past several seasons of his possible retirement. Frankly, I don't think he's going to come back and coach this season. I think that date is extremely optimistic, although I do think that if they get, UConn gets invited to the March Madness, if they get, invited to the big dance, as they call it, which they probably will, I bet Calhoun will find a way to coach there. But if they don't make it, I bet he's probably not even, he's not going to coach. That's being overly optimistic. I doubt it. And, frankly, he might be done, which would be fantastic because I can't stand Jim Calhoun or any number of the commercials that he does, whether it be for one of the banks or the Subway sandwiches. I mean, just any commercials he does, I just can't stand him, nor can I stand UConn. I think it would be a nice blow to the basketball program of UConn, because he is a good coach, I must admit. As much as I dislike him, he is a great coach, and I think it would be a really devastating blow to UConn to lose such a coach. He's been there for quite some time. He's been extremely successful, and he's also sent several players to the NBA. So, he has quite an impressive resume, although he has let a lot of, bullshit go down. They're not exactly squeaky clean at UConn, as one may think. And, they did catch some violations, I believe it was last year. And, so we'll just have to wait and see what the deal is with his health. Okay. Moving right along to a little bit of Yankee talk here. The biggest challenge in the Yankees camp was on display yesterday morning during live batting practice, getting Michael Pinata's changeup to the point where it is trusted weapon. To go with the high-octane fastball and biting slider is number one on the Yankees' to-do list. So on field two with the morning dew still on the grass, the 23-year-old right-hander who was acquired from the Mariners for hitting star Jesus Montero faced Colin Curtis and Melky Mesa, pretty much two nobodies. Seven of Pinata's 25 pitches were changeups to Mesa, and according to left-hand hitting Curtis, the slider had life. According to Curtis, he said that Pinata's a monster. He's 280 pounds. The slider was the best pitch I saw. That's pretty good news for the Yankees. I mean, this guy is big. He is a power right-hander, although Cashman has been downplaying that he's a top-flight pitcher. Due to the fact that the kid only does have two pitches, I think, to pitch in the AL East, you really want to have a little bit more thorough of an arsenal. I mean, unless you're throwing, you know, 98, 99, 100, where you're just totally blowing guys away. But eventually, you know, guys figure you out. I mean, you really, you know, you need three pitches. The Yankees are hoping to circle change index finger and thumb touching to form a circle on the side of the ball, and the other three fingers on the ball will add, add consistency to Pineda's changeup. It's good. I feel comfortable with Pineda, who is initially seemed shocked that reporters wanted to talk to him about the batting practice session. Hey, welcome to New York, buddy. We talk a lot of baseball in New York, and we expect a lot out of you, so expect the microphones to be put right up to you. Pineda followed CC Sabathia on the mound, and Curtis appreciated the two 6'7" hurlers providing shade from the hot morning sun. They kind of blocked the sun out, Curtis joked. George Girardi said he wants to see if Pineda practice the changeup at every available chance. I totally agree with that. You know, the guy, we got to get him working another pitch. It's important he works on it in spring training, according to Girardi. He said that Pineda was scheduled to start Monday against the Phillies in Clearwater. I am not going to get caught up in the numbers. You know, he's only just, you know, searching to improve the changeup. Okay, Girardi yanking the booze. Alcohol is gone from the Yankee clubhouse for there's nothing wrong with a grown man enjoying a beer after a game on a team property. Joe Girardi feels it's a good rule. The Red Sox this week banned beer from the clubhouse during their September collapse last season. Pitchers were reportedly drinking beer during games. Very classy. What an organization who I have always painted with the drunk brush, their fans, and I just find it fantastic that it's, you know, also spread to the team. You know, not only, you know, fans, a bunch of loud, obnoxious drunks, but the team members are also drunks. It's beautiful. Girardi, whose players don't have alcohol available to them on flights that take them home from road trips, got to be careful in this day and age. You don't want people drinking and driving. You don't mind a guy having a beer, but when you are home, you're going to get in the car and drive. I think it's a pretty good policy. Now, there's a little bit of back and forth here with the new Red Sox manager, Bobby Valentine, who's very crafty, and now Terry Francona, who is an analyst. The big booze debate. And you could see Valentine working here. I think that Valentine is a very clever. I think that, he's going to try and rally the team together and kind of the, hey, screw you to Francona, you know. We can do it without you. You know, as you may not recall, Francona is the manager who led the Red Sox to their first World Series title in quite many years. You know, after they were down 3-0, Francona manned the ship. And I think that, things slid away from them. They got away from Francona a little bit. And, obviously Valentine's been brought in. Now, you see, the Red Sox brought in Valentine, but they've brought in very little else. So I think it's extremely important for Valentine to be able to kind of bat down the hatches and get an us against everybody or us against Francona mentality going so we can get a little something, get a little team unity. Because you can be assured that, that locker room probably is unpleasant, you know, which was kind of what was implied from last year, you know, that the pitchers kind of distance themselves, so on and so forth, from the rest of the team, that they have like a little boys club. I find it very interesting, and I spoke with some other people that find this interesting too, that the Red Sox beat reporters kept this a secret. Why were these drinking incidents not being reported in the paper? You would think that the Red Sox beat reporters would want to put that out there so something would be done to stop what was going on. I frankly couldn't imagine such BS going on in the Yankee clubhouse where dudes were getting it in, getting their drink on while other guys are out there, trying to win a ball game. I just don't see that happening in the Yankee clubhouse. I would be shocked. And if it did, I think that, you know, the ringleader will be on the first thing smoking, and that the Yankee beat reporters or someone from the ES Network or something, I mean, it would get put out there. I would just love to hear some responses from some of these Red Sox reporters. You know, why didn't you break that story? I would just love to know, why did you wait to the end of the season until the plane crashed into the side of the mountain? I would just be very interested to hear what exactly the deal was on that. Andy Pettit arrived in camp as a guest instructor. Yogi Berra is expected this weekend, and Reggie Jackson will be there for the final weekend of the exhibition games. New ES announcer Luke Pinello will be in uniform at some point. Bernie Williams is even expected next week for a 10-day stay. Robinson Cano was excused from camp yesterday, a day after his grandmother died. Poor Robbie. Cano is expected to miss a couple of days. This is some great news. Jarvis Chamberlain graduates from a half mound to a full mound today when he throws in the bullpen. Until today, Chamberlain has thrown off 5-inch mounds on the way back from Tommy John surgery. That's really great news. I think the Yankees have really done Jarvis Chamberlain a disservice. You know, is he a closer? Is he a starter? All of that, I think, was a real disservice to his career. And I hope that Jarvis gets some success this year. Frankly, I think they should have been grooming Jarvis to be Mariano Rivera's replacement. I know the Yankees are probably thinking David Robertson, but I don't think he's that. I love David Robertson, but I don't know if he's durable enough to take Mariano Rivera. I think he's got the stuff to do it. I just don't know if he's durable. I think Chamberlain would relish the opportunity to become the new Mariano Rivera. As you know, this may be Rivera's last year. Who knows? I frankly don't think it is. I think that would be great if it wasn't. I think that, the Yankees should, when Chamberlain gets around to him, make him the eighth inning guy and, should start getting ready to replace, Rivera. Maybe they could split the closing role next season, and maybe that would be it for Rivera. Maybe this season and one more season. But I don't know. The Yankees officially announced signing of utility corner infielder Eric Chavez. Very important. Chavez signed a 1-year deal worth $900,000 plus performance bonuses. This is a good move. It gives Alex Rodriguez a nice backup. Chavez is great. He's good with the bat. He's not going to screw you in the infield. So you gotta like that. I think, A-Rod's going to see a lot of DH this season. They want to try and keep him healthy. So I bet we'll see a good bit of Chavez. Outfielder Chris Dickerson was deleted from the 40-man roster Sunday to make room for Chavez, who will back up, obviously, A-Rod and, part-time Mark Teixeira. I wouldn't read anything into Phil Hughes pitching behind CeCe Sabathia Tuesday against the Pirates. He'll pitch like a starter that day. Manager Joe Girardi said of Hughes, who is competing for a rotation spot, but does have bullpen experience. Now, what they mean by that is, supposedly he's competing for the final spot with Freddy Garcia, but that's total bullshit. Garcia is going to be the long man. They just don't want to insult Garcia, and they don't want Hughes just think he can cruise into the job, especially after he showed up to camp last year overweight, and that really set the Yankees behind. As you know, he had to, get out of his arm strength and so forth, and it really, wasn't what the Yankees had planned. Garcia will fill the role as long man. He's going to do a fine job there. You couldn't ask for a better long man. I think, if the Yankees' pitching situation pans out, I think the Yankees are going to have a really good year. I don't, the Red Sox, in my mind, haven't improved at all. However, they do have some guys that really played shitty last year and some guys that were banged up. So maybe they didn't need to improve the game. I mean, they certainly don't think they feel they needed to improve the team. They had Big Bobby back, Euclid, Pedroia, so we'll see. They have Carl Crawford in the outfield, who did absolutely nothing last year. So maybe he'll settle down and use some of his speed this year. We'll certainly have to wait to see. I think the Red Sox have issues in the pitching department, though. Beckett with his back, Clay Buchholz is always injured, and that lefty whose name I'm losing right now, we always seem to give him. John Lester, we always seem to give him, a hard time. I just don't think their pitching staff is as strong as they think it is. I really don't. Their closer's gone. thank God I couldn't stand him. He was garbage anyway. But they filled the, you know, the closer's role with Bard. And Bard's fastball is so straight that he was, they were using it as a level at construction sites this season in Boston. That's how straight his 100-mile-an-hour fastball is. So, you know, Bard, I think he'll get banged up all year. I think the Red Sox are going to have problems finding a closer. And we're going to see just how important Mariano Rivera is, because I think the Red Sox are going to struggle getting games closed. I think eventually they're going to end up going to the old closer by committee, but we'll certainly have to wait to see. But it's going to be an interesting baseball season. I'll talk more about it. You know, it's only pitchers and catchers. And, you know, as the weird injuries come in, and they always do, there's always some crazy injuries, you know. A guy sprained his arm playing a pinball machine or something. There's always crazy stuff, crazy injuries going on. So as those come rolling in, which they will, I will certainly talk about those and, you know, and any, you know, other major injuries. Like, I see Ray Sizemore, formerly of the Cleveland Indians. He's done for the season. He blew his knee out, ACL. He's not playing for the Indians. He's playing somewhere else. I just happened to notice that on the injury wire. So as the big-time injuries come in, I'll certainly report those as well. But that's it for this week. Shout-out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Breaking ASS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, Mighty Mike, my boy, Ed. That's it for this week. I think the warm weather will be here soon enough. Springtime's coming, but according to the weatherman, it's going to snow tomorrow. But maybe he'll be wrong, and for Christ's sake, they're not going to write that often. So we'll certainly see. That's it for this week. Peace out, everybody.
Thank you, Woody. Silencing the Critics, that is long, but there are little parts of it that we can...
I read part of it. You can go to paulcraigroberts.org and pick it up. It's called Silencing the Critics.
Institute for Political Economy. You need to make that a little bigger so we can
see. I'm going to do that. Okay, and...
we'll just read a little bit of this.
The important thing about it is it talks about silencing the critics and how...
certain voices have gone off from the media.
The mainstream media is getting clobbered. There is no more critical voices on there anymore.
In 2010, the FBI invaded the homes of peace activists in several states and seized personal possessions in what the FBI, the lead orchestrator of the fake terrorist plots, called an investigation of activities concerning the material support of terrorism. Subpoenas were issued to compel anti-war protesters to testify before grand juries as prosecutors set about building their case that opposing Washington's wars of aggression constitutes giving aid and comfort to terrorists. The purpose of the raids and grand jury subpoenas was to chill the anti-war movement into inaction.
Last week, in one fell swoop, the... last two remaining critics of Washington and Tel Aviv imperialism were removed from the mainstream media. Judge Napolitano's popular program, Freedom Watch, was canceled by Fox TV, and Pat Buchanan was fired by MSNBC. Both pundits had wide followings and were appreciated for speaking frankly.
Many suspect that the Israel lobby used its clout with TV advertisers to silence critics of the Israeli government's efforts to lead Washington to war with Iran. Regardless, the point before us is that the voice of the mainstream media is now uniform. Americans hear one voice, one message, and the message is propaganda. Dissent is tolerated only on such issues as to whether employer-paid health benefits should pay for contraceptive devices. Constitutional rights have been replaced with the right to free condoms.
The Western media demonizes those of whom Washington points a finger, and the lies pour forth to justify Washington's naked aggression. The Taliban are conflated with Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein was weapons of mass destruction, and Gaddafi is a terrorist, and even worse, fortified his troops with Viagra in order to commit mass rape against Libyan women.
I didn't hear that one.
No, it's probably been out there.
President Obama and members of Congress, along with Tel Aviv, continue to assert that Iran is making a nuclear weapon despite public contradiction by the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, and the CIA's National Intelligence Estimate. According to news reports, Pentagon Chief Leon Panetta told members of the House of Representatives on February 16th that Tehran has not made a decision to proceed with developing a nuclear weapon. However, in Washington, facts don't count. Only the material interests of powerful interest groups matter.
At the moment, the American Ministry of Truth is splitting its time between lying about Iran and lying about Syria. Recently, there were some explosions in faraway Thailand, and the explosions were blamed on Iran. But last October, the FBI announced that the Bureau had uncovered an Iranian plot to pay a used car salesman to hire a Mexican drug gang to kill the Saudi Arabia ambassador to the U.S. The White House idiot professed to believe the unbelievable plot and declared that he had strong evidence, but no evidence was ever released. The purpose for announcing the non-existent plot was to justify Obama's sanctions, which amount to an embargo, an act of war against Iran for developing nuclear energy.
As a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has the right to develop nuclear energy, and IAEA inspectors are permanently in Iran and report no diversion of nuclear material to a weapons program. In other words, according to the reports of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the U.S. National Intelligence Estimate, and the current Secretary of Defense, there is no evidence that Iran has nukes or is making nukes. Yet Obama has placed the illegal sanctions on Iran and continues to threaten Iran with military attack on the basis of an accusation that is contradicted by all known evidence.
How can such a thing happen? It can happen because there is no Helen Thomas, who also was eliminated by the Israeli lobby, to question as a member of the White House press President Obama why he placed warlike sanctions on Iran when his own CIA and his own Secretary of Defense, along with the IAEA, report there's no basis for the sanctions. The idea that the U.S. is a democracy when it most definitely does not have a free watchdog press is laughable. But the media is not laughing. It is lying. Just like the government, every time the U.S. mainstream media opens its mouth or writes one word, it is lying. And indeed, its corporate masters pay its employees to tell lies. That is their job. Tell the truth and you are history, like Buchanan and Napolitano and Helen Thomas.
What the Ministry of Truth calls peaceful protesters brutalized by Assad's military are in fact rebels armed and financed by Washington. Washington has fomented a civil war. Washington claims its intention is to rescue the oppressed and abused Syrian people from Assad, just as Washington rescued the oppressed and abused Libyan people from Gaddafi. Today, liberated Libya is a shell of its former self, terrorized by clashing militias. Thanks to Obama, another country has been destroyed. Reports of atrocities committed against Syrian civilians by the military could be true, but the reports come from the rebels who desire Western intervention to put them into power. Moreover, how would these civilian casualties differ from the ones inflicted on the Bahraini civilians by the U.S.-supported Bahraini government, the military of which is forfeited by Saudi Arabian troops? Saudi Arabian troops. There is no outcry in the Western press about Washington's blind eye to civilian atrocities committed by its puppet states.
And how do the Syrian atrocities, if they are real, differ from Washington's atrocities in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo prison, and secret CIA prison sites? Why is the American Ministry of Truth silent about these massive, unprecedented violations of human rights? Well, remember, also the reports of Serbian atrocities in Kosovo that Washington and Germany used to justify NATO and U.S. bombings of Serbian civilians, including the Chinese consulate, dismissed as another collateral damage. Now, 13 years later, a prominent German TV program has revealed that the photographs that ignited the atrocity campaign were grossly misrepresented and were not photographs of atrocities committed by Serbs, but Albanian separatists killed in a firefight between armed Albanians and Serbians. Serbian casualties were not shown. The problem that truth faces is that the Western media continually lies, and on the rare instances that the lies are corrected, it is always long after the event, and therefore the crimes enabled by the media have been accomplished. Washington set its puppet Arab League upon Syria in order to establish Syria's isolation among its own kind, and better to attack Syria. Assad forestalled Washington's setup of Syria for destruction by calling a nationwide referendum on the 26th of February to establish a new constitution that would extend the prospect of rule beyond the Baathists.
This is quite a long article.
Yeah.
And, but it's very, very interesting.
And I suggest that you go to it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I'll just finish with the last couple of paragraphs because I think it's interesting.
The U.S. has no independent print.
No, I was going to go this way.
Okay.
Why isn't the American mainstream media raising questions about these risks? And is it worth blowing up the world in order to stop Iran from having a nuclear energy program or even a nuclear weapon? Does Washington think China is unaware that Washington is taking aim at its energy supply? Does Washington think Russia is unaware that it is being encircled by hostile military bases?
Whose interests are being served by Washington's endless and multi-trillion dollar wars? Certainly not the interests of the 50 million Americans with no access to health care, nor the 1,500,000 American children who are homeless, living in cars, rundown motel rooms, tent cities, and the storm sewers under Las Vegas, while huge accounts of public funds are used to bail out banks and squandered in wars of hegemony. The U.S. has no independent print and TV media. It has prostitutes who are paid for the lies that they tell. The U.S. government, in its pursuit of its immoral aims, has attained the status of the most corrupt government in human history. Yet Obama speaks as if Washington is the font of human morality.
The U.S. government does not represent Americans. It represents a few special interests and a foreign power. U.S. citizens simply don't count, and certainly Afghans, Iraqis, Libyans, Somalians, Yemenis, and Pakistanis don't count. Now, Washington regards truth, justice, and mercy as laughable values. Money, power, hegemony are all what that count for Washington, and the city upon the hill, the light unto nations, the example for the world.
That's pretty sad, isn't
it? And that was by Paul Roberts.
Paul Craig Roberts,
yeah.
Institute for Political Economy,
yeah.
And it's silencing the critics.
Yeah, so I suggest you check that out.
Yeah,
and,
good article.
And please join us tomorrow night when we have our interview with Tex Mars. I would have a 45-minute interview. And Tex is the host of the Power of Prophecy and author of, I don't know, probably 20 different books.
Oh, at least.
Best-selling, all bestsellers. And please join us tomorrow night. And I guarantee you.
He's always an interesting.
And his latest DVD is called Die, America, Die, which is the Illuminati. He talks about the Illuminati and the forces that be.
Have taken over.
Have decided America must die, and why that is. So, in the meantime, I want to thank everybody for joining us, and we wish you a very pleasant evening.
And we thank Woody in the Ring for his segment, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Have a great night, folks.
Good night.